Well, it certainly has been a busy and interesting week. Whiny millennials are throwing themselves down on grocery store floors and in temper tantrums because they don't like guns. And apparently the dog man has been shot and killed so it won't terrorize anyone anymore. And we have a very good interview with a good friend, Carl Tykrib. So you want to make sure that you stay tuned for that. All right, welcome to Josh Peck Disclosure. So glad to be with you again today. Now, we've had to do something a little bit different. This YouTube censorship is just insane. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, and I'm going to go into detail on some emails that we've had back and forth with YouTube, but it's just gone crazy. So I started a new YouTube channel for this weekly show, and we'll just see how that goes. I don't know. But head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com and check that out. But make sure you subscribe. You got to click the bell. You got to tell it that you always want it to be to notify you when we do a new video. You got to tell it all that stuff. So make sure you do that. But like I've said before, the central hub for everything Josh Peck Disclosure is joshpeckdisclosure.com. Make sure you check it out. Go and subscribe to the YouTube channels that are listed there. You'll see them all the videos and everything. Make sure you subscribe to them all. And you have to click the little bell, unfortunately, to get notified. And even then, you might not. So just know that every day a new video is going to be up. And every week you'll get the full show. Okay, so to start off, apparently Ireland has voted to legalize abortion. So I guess in Ireland, killing babies is okay now. You know, they're over like 70% Catholic or something. I didn't think that Catholics were for abortion. It's strange. But so Irish citizens have voted to legalize abortion on this past Friday, ending Ireland's legacy as one of the most pro-life nations. The votes are still being officially counted at the time of this recording, but the pro-abortion campaign is declaring victory, and pro-lifers are calling this a tragedy of historic proportions. Here's a quote from the Pro-Life Save the Eighth campaign. This is what they said in the statement, quote, "The Eighth Amendment did not create a right to life for the unborn child. It merely acknowledged that such a right exists, that it has always existed and will always exist. What Irish voters did yesterday is a tragedy of historic proportions. However, a wrong does not become right simply because a majority support it." Hey, that's very true. I actually think, well, I hope, hopefully it happens sooner than this, but I think there's going to come a time where in the future people, citizens will look back, citizens of America will look back to our time today, and they're going to think of abortion the same way we think of slavery from years and years ago. So I hope this abortion stuff ends sooner than that, but I think that's what's going to happen. So Ireland has made one of the lowest maternal mortality rates in the world. They had that. The Eighth Amendment of its constitution guaranteed equal rights for preborn babies and their mothers. So repealing the Eighth Amendment was the decades-long goal of the abortion movement. The Irish voted by 67% to add the Eighth Amendment to their constitution in 1983, making the Emerald Isle a uniquely safe place for preborn babies, in contrast to the rest of the West's liberal abortion regimes, like what we have to deal with here in the U.S. Now, there have been five previous votes on repealing the Eighth Amendment, all which failed. One was in 1983, three of them were in 1992, and there was another one in 2002. But of course, that wasn't enough for them to give it up. So more people in Dublin, where the majority of residents supported the repeal campaign, voted in this referendum that in 2015 on same-sex marriage and in their general election. So one student's union in Dublin created a safe space-like chill zone where students could de-stress as the results were counted. It became apparent that abortion advocates had won and only 14 students utilized the room. So the Guardian reported that an exit poll showed around 87% of 18 to 24 year olds voted for abortion. 87% in that range. It's the younger generation that's really driving this kind of stuff, and we see that here in the U.S. too. So in early 2018, the Irish government approved putting the Eighth Amendment to a vote in May with the promise that if it passed, legislation allowing abortions in demand would be introduced. The proposed legislation, which may be introduced later on, is expected to be abortion on demand during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy for healthy babies and later throughout pregnancy for nebulous health reasons that are never clearly defined, because of course they're not going to be. It's open to interpretation. But that's for babies with disabilities and babies conceived in rape and stuff like that. Now, pro-life activists responded to the referendum in a massive canvassing and public awareness campaign about how many lives have been saved by the Eighth Amendment, how one in five babies in England are aborted, and the fact that abortion kills a living human being, of course, and the many harms to women in society that comes with legalizing it. Here's another quote from Save the Eighth's defeat statement. It says, the unborn child no longer has a right to life recognized by the Irish state. Shortly, legislation will be introduced that will allow babies to be killed in our country. We will oppose that legislation if and when abortion clinics are opened in Ireland because of the inability of the government to keep their promise about a GP-led service. We will oppose that as well. Every time an unborn child has his or her life ended in Ireland, we will oppose that and make our voices known. End quote. So this country that was once known for its strong Catholic heritage and identity. They voted in 2015 to amend its constitution to permit same-sex marriage, and despite Ireland's move towards secularism and approval of redefining marriage, polls on how the Eighth Amendment vote would go were extremely close toward the end of the abortion vote. So in 2012, a woman named Savita Halappanavar, I'm sure I'm butchering that, who was 17 weeks pregnant, she died of sepsis at Galway University Hospital, and three official investigations found that the 31-year-old died of a blood infection caused by extremely virulent bacteria E. coli ESBL. Under Ireland's abortion laws, the woman would have been permitted an abortion, and doctors realized how had the doctors realized how sick she was when she came to the hospital, but they didn't, and her death was due to medical negligence, not lack of abortion. Official investigations have revealed this. So according to the Health Information and Quality Authority, which investigated her death, doctors missed 13 opportunities to save her life. So Irish abortion activists have exploited Savita's case and lied about her death, culminating in Friday's vote. So they said that it was because it was a lack of abortion or whatever. The Irish politicians who pushed for the repeal of the Eighth Amendment squirmed around when asked about the abortion proposal that they were championing, and other abortion advocates, like the country's lesbian minister for children, simply denied the humanity of those still in the womb, but still others admitted the preborn are humans, but advocated for killing them anyway. All right, so this is going to keep happening throughout the world. You know, it's ironic that people who are advocating this stuff think that they're being progressive, but it's regressive. You know, in humanity's ancient past, that's when they would kill their own children, usually to sacrifice their kids to some god or something. But now, it's not a sacrifice to some god, it's a sacrifice to convenience. It's a sacrifice to a woman's convenience, and even a man's convenience, too, if the man is pushing for it. They want to scream women's rights, and oh, what if she gets raped, and what if the child is sick? You know, that accounts for such a small percentage of what actually happens. Most times, overwhelmingly, and there are studies showing this, it's because of convenience. It's because they can't afford the baby, you know, so to speak, which who can? Any of you who have kids out there, you know, you're never really ready, you know, but you have the kid, you trust in God, and you're fine. But even if it's not, it's a lot better than killing the thing first and anticipating that everything is just going to be bad if you don't. So this is going to keep happening. This is an ongoing problem. We're going to see this more and more and more, unfortunately, but that's why we need to get out there, get the word out there, get the truth out there. And thankfully, more stronger voices are speaking up against this abortion stuff. So hopefully that will continue. There was a recent story that it's kind of funny, but it's kind of sad too. It's sad that it had to come out in this way, but it's funny because it's just so obvious. So a second grader's essay has been making big news because there's a quote in there that says, "I hate my mom's cell phone and I wish she never had one." And this essay has gone viral because of this. Because it speaks to a truth. I mean, we are addicted to our cell phones. And I actually wouldn't limit that to only parents. I would say kids are too. So my daughter is going into second grade in a couple of months. So she's about this age. And I mean, it's really heartbreaking stuff. So a Louisiana second grader's homework assignment is totally going viral, making parents across the nation question if they spend too much time on their cell phones. This is something we should all be asking ourselves, you know, are we neglecting our kids? I mean, sure, yeah, we feed them and, you know, we tell them to go outside and play, even though maybe they want to watch TV or whatever. But are we telling our kids too much? Leave mommy and daddy alone. When I'm on the phone, I'm working. When I'm on the phone, I'm working. So just leave us alone. Maybe we're doing that too much. So teacher Jen Adams Beeson wrote in a since deleted Facebook post that she assigned her students to write about an invention they wish had never been created. And she posted an essay in which one of the students picked the cell phone as the invention that she wished was never created. Quote, "I don't like the phone because my parents are on the phone every day. I hate my mom's phone and I wish she never had one," this student wrote. The student capped off the essay with a drawing of a cell phone with a big X through it and a sad face saying, "I hate it." Now, Beeson revealed that out of 21 of her students, four of them actually wrote about this topic. So this isn't just one. At the end of her post, Beeson added the hashtag get off your phones and hashtag listen to your kids. Now, according to a 2017 survey, half of parents found that using technology disrupted time with their children three or more times a day. So what do you think? You know, I'm curious about this too. Do you think we spend too much time on our cell phones? Now, part of it too is sometimes you need to be on your phone if that's a part of your job. But also, this might be controversial, but maybe we work too much even. You know, maybe we work too much and we don't spend enough time with our kids. I remember when I was a kid, you know, kids don't understand the concept of work. Now, when I was a kid, my mom, she was going to college, so it was kind of the same kind of thing. But I didn't really understand what any of that meant. Kids aren't going to get that. You know, I leave me alone, I have to work, I love you, but, you know, go play or something. Maybe sometimes that's called for and maybe sometimes it's appropriate, but I think that we as parents can get our priorities flipped. You know, we think that, especially men, you know, and I totally understand this mindset. You got to actually fight against it because if you're a man, you know, some women too, but usually if you're a man, then you want to go out and work as well. You should. I mean, if you're a man, you got to take care of your family. But when that becomes the main driving force, you know, well, I got to take care of my family. I have to put food on the table. And then you're spending all your time at work. And then you're not giving your children or your wife any love and companionship and any of that good family stuff. That's needed, too. And I would say that's more important than work and providing. I mean, you need to do that. But with the work stuff, and it's easy for us men to get competitive and to really want to put everything that we have into our job because it's almost an unconscious status symbol. You know, the more that you can succeed, the more well off you are and the better you're providing for your family. And there's all sorts of ways of justifying it. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't go out and make money. We do need to do that. We need to provide for our family. But we don't only need to provide for their physical needs. We need to provide for their emotional and spiritual needs as well. And when the father isn't in the home as the spiritual leader, that can cause a lot of problems. So I think that this is just one small example of a larger issue. But I'm interested to know what you think. Okay, so whiny millennials who don't like our guns have decided that they're going to throw a temper tantrum, throw themselves on the ground in a grocery store and scream and hold their breath until things change. You know, it's so funny because they act like, I believe they do want to be taken seriously, but they act like kids. I mean, any of you who are parents, you probably know this whole deal. You take your 3 or 4 year old into the store and they want candy and you say no, and then they scream and they throw themselves on the ground and then you leave them and you go home and... No, I'm kidding. You don't leave your kid in the store. But you know, you do what you have to do to get them to stop. You know, when adults, it doesn't matter if they're millennials. I'm a millennial too, and I don't behave like this. But when adults, either millennials or even younger, the generation younger than that, act in this way, it is impossible to take them seriously. It's these Parkland gun control activists. You know the group. They're all over news. You know, and I think what a lot of this is especially David Hogg, I think that he's realizing his 15 minutes of fame are up, and he hasn't built any kind of foundation to support himself through that. So he's got to do these kind of boycotts and activist stuff, and he's got to throw a temper tantrum, basically. Now, there are others who take a more well-reasoned and balanced approach, like this kid, Kyle Khushchev. Now, he's actually building a foundation for himself. You know, he's pro-gun, and he brings up a lot of good reasons. He actually wanted to debate David Hogg, but David Hogg didn't want to or whatever. But anyway, he's handling it the right way, and it's not just because he's got views that happen to agree with mine. You know, it may be a little bit because of that, but he's building a foundation for himself. You know, he'll actually go and do interviews, and he brings up good reasons and why he believes what he believes. And he doesn't buy into this. He doesn't do any of this nonsense. So while his name may not be as well known today as somebody like David Hogg, I think he's gonna Kyle Khushchev is gonna far outlast David Hogg and all these other Parkland gun activists. But so they threw themselves on the floor in a Florida grocery store on last Friday, screaming and yelling for customers to boycott the store because of political donations that it made. So it was called a die-in, and it was organized by the far left activist and provocateur David Hogg, who's launched multiple boycotts aimed at those who support the NRA or who criticize him. Now on Twitter, and keep in mind, this is still a kid, I guess, I don't know if he's 17 or 18, what, but he's definitely acting like a kid, but he's still a kid. So, but at the same time, he's playing an adult's game here by getting involved in this, and it's just atrocious. So on Twitter, Hogg wrote, at Publix is a NRA sellout in Parkland. We will have a die-in the Friday, the 25th, before Memorial Day weekend, starting from 4 p.m. for 12 minutes inside our two Publix stores. Just go and lay down starting at 4. Feel free to die in with us at as many other Publix as possible. So CBS News reported that Publix actually caved to the leftist pressure and intimidation tactics, announcing that they have decided to suspend corporate-funded political contributions as we reevaluate our giving processes. That's a direct quote. Also, quote, "We regret that our contributions have led to a divide in our community," end quote. That's what Publix has said in a statement to CBS News. Quote, also, quote, "We did not intend to put our associates and the customers they serve in the middle of a political debate," end quote. They didn't. Okay, the store didn't put the customers they serve in the middle of a political debate. David Hogg and his cronies did. You don't ever apologize for this stuff. You don't ever cave. If should have gave more money to the NRA, because this is what's going to make this stuff continue. They see that we got our way. They're going to keep doing it, and their demands are never going to be met because they're going to keep moving the goalposts. They're going to keep creating new demands and new demands and new demands. And you see this in any of this leftist activism, that they have a list of demands that they say will never go beyond that, and then once they get them, they go beyond that. You know, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Just look at everything in identity politics. What they said 10, 20 years ago, we won't go that far, that's crazy. We're now seeing it. Like, we don't want separate bath, or we don't want to go in any bathroom we want. You're still going to have boys and girls locker rooms and boys and girls bathrooms. And then you look at, 10 or 20 years later and look where we are now. So that's going to keep happening. That's why you don't ever cave. And I'm sad that Publix has caved to this type of pressure, especially because it's children. It's the same as if your child is screaming because they don't get a candy bar. Publix, these organizations, they're that parent that says, okay, if you're quiet, I'll get you one. Okay. It doesn't solve anything. It's making the people involved just rotten to the core, and it's going to keep getting worse. All right. So I want to tell you about these recent back and forth emails that I've had with YouTube. So those of you who have followed this channel, or at least have tried to, I've been getting a lot of messages from you saying that you don't get notified. Even though you've subscribed, even though you click the bell, you don't get notified. So I reached out to YouTube to try to get some answers on this, because I've noticed that we only get a few hundred views per video when I have over 20,000 subscribers. And the quality of everything's just increasing. You know, I've built YouTube channels in the past. I know how to do it, but under these new rules, these new shadow banning and censorship rules that YouTube takes part in, it's impossible. So I reached out to him, and I was polite. Because, you know, when you talk to people like this, you're not going to get anywhere if you just start berating them. And you want to try to be their friend, and you want to try to work with them at least at first and say, hey, you know, I want this to work out too. So I reached out to him and I said, basically, you know, I'm only getting a couple hundred views. I'm only getting a couple hundred views on YouTube. I want my channel to work. I want to be able to, you know, sometimes you got to speak in their own terms too. You know, I'm not going to tell them I want to spread the gospel and I really want to just get the truth out there. And so while I do want to do that and I am doing that, they're not going to understand that language. So I said, basically, you know, I want us both to make a lot of money because you got to speak to them in their own terms. But I said, you know, if my subscribers don't have access to my videos, then YouTube's losing out on money too. It's not just me. I can make that up through donations or whatever, and that's what keeps the show going. But anyway, so I contacted them and they wrote back. So I'm not going to read all of this because it's really long, but if you've ever contacted YouTube or really any company, you know when you're getting an automated response and when you're not. So the first one here is from somebody named, I talked to three different people. Every time I replied, they kept giving me somebody new. So this one is from Morna, and it says, Josh, thanks for reaching out. I understand that you are concerned about, not concerned, but I am concerned about your subscribers' notification and your video views. I provided some information to clarify how it works. Only to clarify, not to provide any solutions. Here are the possible reasons users may not be getting all notifications. They are not logged into the YouTube app on their mobile phone. Bell settings are set to none for this channel, even though, and I said in my thing, I said that people who have been writing me say that they click on the bell and they're still not getting notified. So then they're offering this as a solution. Maybe the bell's not clicked. That's how you know it's not, that's how you know it's an auto response when they don't directly address the questions that you ask. They have not chosen to receive all notifications. Some users who are still in the default setting receiving occasional notifications may think they opted into all. Ask viewers to check their bell settings to ensure they have opted into all notifications. So make sure you all do that if you haven't. Make sure they have the right notification account setting, i.e. push or email. Another, maybe they're not subscribed. Since non-subscribed users sometimes receive notifications, they may think they are subscribed when they're not. So go to youtube.com/Josh Peck Disclosure. Make sure you're subscribed. Make sure you click on the bell and do all these things. Users of the YouTube app or mobile device notification setting may be turned off. If either of those are off, a viewer is not eligible to receive notifications. A user may unsubscribe and resubscribe without adjusting their notification settings to receive all notifications. Viewers get a maximum of five uploads and five live stream notifications from each channel in a 24-hour period. When you upload a YouTube video, you can decide whether the video will send notifications to your subscribers, which of course I want it to send that all. And I only post one video a day. I don't do more than five a day. I don't want to annoy you guys to death. And so then there was a lot of other just basic copy and paste stuff. Very rarely we encounter an issue within our system that can cause substantial delays in delivery of notifications. That's not true, because I've heard from multiple channels, people who are running their own channels, that they have this issue too. So what they're saying is, very rarely is it anything with our system. It can't be. It must be on your end. That's what they're telling me. So they wanted me to send them the links to the videos that I was having problems with, and which is hard to do because it's all of them. It's every video. There's not one that I can point to. But still, I decided to try anyway. So I wrote back and I said, thank you, Morna. It would be tough to send you links to the videos I have questions about because it is all of them. I work in television and run two other channels. It's actually three, but I work in television and run two other channels. I know my audience very well. I also constantly get emails from them saying they aren't notified of my videos when one goes up, which is daily. It used to be about a year ago, maybe more, I would get thousands of views on any video I produced. Then all of a sudden, now I'm lucky if I even break 1,000, which never happens anymore. I have heard a lot about shadow banning and algorithms, the Project Veritas exposés and PragerU and James Damore lawsuits. And I wonder if that is what's happening to my channel or if it's something similar to that. I really don't want to believe that, and I hope we can find a solution either way. I do political commentary. I also talk a lot about Christianity. I do not use offensive language, hate speech, like there is such a thing, or anything like that. None of my videos are flagged. Not a single one of them are flagged. I've got all perfect scores in the channel guidelines and everything. Many times I have videos that when I upload them, I have to request a review to get it monetized. Usually monetization is granted after a few days, though this is still very frustrating. Also, when I first upload a video, I will get about 4 or 5 views per minute for the first hour or so. Then the view count drastically dwindles and slows down to a stop. This is another thing telling me only a small fraction of my subscribers are being notified. And actually, since this time, it's gone down even more. Since I've been in contact with YouTube, the views have gone down even more than they were. Now my last video only got about 80 views. So now it's not even in the hundreds anymore. They're really trying to stop this information from getting out, stop this channel, to stop you from having access to the videos that you want. So I continued on and said it took years to build my subscriber list, but again, about a year ago, on all channels I manage, new subscribers dwindled down. I tell viewers in every video to subscribe, click the bell, but this has done no good. This does no good if they aren't being notified and if they don't see the video anyway. So I can say in every single video, make sure you click on the bell, but it does no good if nobody's seeing it. And I said, there are two anomalies. There are two videos that have somehow made it past whatever is blocking my videos from being seen and have received the number of views I was used to receiving. I have since tried to duplicate the success, even down to using nearly identical tags, titles, and improving subject matter on and video/audio quality, but I have not been able to reproduce the results. These are the two videos, and there's one, are we headed for a second world, or are we headed for a second civil war? That got 105,000 views and climbing. And then another one, did the Weather Channel just confirm our biggest fears about Yellowstone? And that one has 81,000 views and climbing. That was about what I was used to before YouTube started censoring and shadow banning and not letting you guys see videos. I was getting about that. I was getting in the tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands per video. So I said, here are two similar videos that I tried to duplicate the very high view count with. I mean, they're not identical videos. They're still unique. They're still interesting. But one, how a second civil war in the United States can happen and the aftermath, 537 views. Yellowstone supervolcano alert, 200-mile underground hotspot just discovered, 12,207 views. So a little bit better on the Yellowstone one, absolutely dismal on the second Civil War one. But I wrote, as you can see, the view count is dismal. Also, it is not due to poor quality or lack of viewer interest, because when I upload the same videos to Facebook, which my page only has about 500 likes right now, by the way, facebook.com/Josh Peck Disclosure, I just started it and my personal account has 5,000 friends, far fewer than the number of subscribers I have on YouTube. I get way more views on Facebook than I do on YouTube, usually about 4 to 5 times the amount. Still not great, but 2,500 is a lot better than 200. I said, I have my show, Josh Peck Disclosure, across many different platforms, and the only major hit I've taken is from YouTube. It's hard for me to believe that this is just due to viewers not being interested, because they are extremely interested across all other platforms. They were extremely interested up until about a year or so ago. The other YouTube channels I run are facing the same exact thing, and they are all very different in subject matter, because I have Chalk Talk into the multiverse. I in part run the Skywatch TV YouTube channel. It's me and some other people. But yet on YouTube, all videos suffer. I'm even getting more views on Vimeo, and no one uses Vimeo because they are terrible compared to YouTube. They're not as terrible in terms of censorship, but you can't monetize anything, and nobody uses Vimeo, and you got to pay to have more videos up, and it is really terrible. However, I'm wondering if it would be worth it to just move to Vimeo, so I'm telling them this. And then I said, you know, I honestly really do want this to work. I want it to work with YouTube and getting this matter resolved. You know, no matter what the case is, whether it's suppression or censorship or just whatever it is, I want it to stop, basically. And then I sent a long list of videos just on the first page that I'm having trouble with. So they wrote back and It's somebody new this time, Anne, and said, Morna is out of the office. First, I checked your videos and confirmed that they are searchable. I've attached screenshots. In the screenshots, she attached the Civil War one that's doing really well. So they're not actually like reading any of this, or they're not taking it seriously. We know that you put a ton of time and energy into making videos, and it's important for you to understand how they get discovered. It's just patronizing, and then they just go on, and it's basically another copy and paste job. Instead of worrying about what the algorithm likes, it's better to focus on what your audience likes instead, as if I don't. And all of you who are able to watch this know that. I always take criticism, and I always want to make the show better, and the only way it can be better is if I can hear back from you. So when I hear good constructive criticism, man, I take it and I implement it. So I'm obviously very focused on that, but YouTube doesn't care about that. So that's basically what they're saying, and that it's not a problem on their end. Of course, how could it be? She didn't address any of my real issues. So I said, I replied and said, as I said in my previous email, I know what it takes to grow a channel. I'm constantly checking analytics, because that was something else that they told me to do. Make sure you check your analytics, like anybody knows that. I do exactly what my audience wants to see. That's how I was able to gain over 20,000 subscribers. Yet, I'm only getting a few hundred views when I used to get thousands. I didn't change anything on my end. How is it my audience is interested enough to subscribe, yet not interested enough to watch? It doesn't make any sense. I'm also getting contacted by some of my subscribers saying they subscribed, clicked the bell, yet are not being notified when I post a video. As I said in my last email, my audience has been watching my videos in expected numbers on other platforms, so why not on YouTube? I'm on TV and run other channels. All other platforms are increasing in views and audience interest, yet YouTube across the board has taken a massive hit all around the same time. I really do wish it was as easy of a problem as my audience not being interested, because that's something I could fix. However, there are too many inconsistencies with that narrative for it to be true. It seems a big part of this is my audience is not being notified when a new video goes up. So then they reply, "Hi Josh, this is JM stepping in for Anne, since Anne and Morna are out of the office." So another person. And then yet it is another copy and paste job. It's another auto response. I've reviewed your channel as part of our longstanding effort to keep YouTube authentic. We begin to periodically audit the views a video has received. While in the past we would scan views for spam immediately when they occurred, now we periodically validate videos' view count retroactively, removing fraudulent views as new evidence comes to light. We also have a Help Center article, blah, blah, blah. So they're changing the view count. Now they say it's because of fraudulent views and we're supposed to just trust that, but there's no way that, because again, I get the emails, I get the messages, I know how many of you are out there. There's no way that they're taking off real views. Maybe a couple of them are fraudulent, I don't know, but they're taking off actual real views. There are times where I'll have more comments than I do views. Like, you can't separately comment on a video if you're not watching it. So it's ridiculous. I replied and I said, "Honestly, when my direct answers are not, when my direct questions are not addressed, it makes me think these are all just auto-respond messages or copy and paste jobs. Do I need to address the same questions and concerns a fourth time?" Again, it's the same thing. "Hi, Josh. Thanks for writing back. I really appreciate your interest." They've started every email with that same thing. "But unfortunately, I do not have any more information at this point. I have already shared all the details in my previous email. I'm happy to sum it up one more time, though. I assure you the view count mechanism of the video is working as intended. When users subscribe to your channel, they'll automatically get notifications with highlights of your activity and see any new videos for the subscription feed, unless they opt in and receive all notifications. Here are the possible reasons that they might not be getting notifications." And then they just copied and pasted everything they already said. So, okay, I can't get anywhere with YouTube. I don't think they care. I don't think they care about you. I don't think they care about me. I think they only care about pushing a leftist agenda, and we obviously don't fit into that mold. They only care about pushing an anti-Christian agenda, and clearly they know that we don't fit into that mold. You know, you even see this in Facebook. Facebook is obviously has a lot of problems with this too. Have you seen the more recent Facebook commercial?
"We came here for the friends. And we got to know the friends of our friends. And we found others just like us. And just like that, we felt a little less alone. But then something happened. We had to deal with spam, clickbait, fake news, and data misuse. That's going to change. From now on, Facebook will do more to keep you safe and protect your privacy, so we can all get back to what made Facebook good in the first place. Friends. Because when this place does what it was built for, then we all get a little closer.
It's totally ridiculous. It's, oh, everything was all happy and fine up until fake news started in. And you know, basically people like me. Fake news started in and ruined everybody's good time. But it's okay because we here at Facebook are taking steps to ensure that that's not going to happen anymore. They're kicking us off their platforms, basically. So I'm going to be looking into some new areas, some new things to do that won't have to... I don't know. That won't have to... depend on YouTube and other things. I am on DTube. I'm on some other places. But for the weekly show, what I'm thinking I'm going to do, and I'm recording these ahead of time, so by the time you actually watch this video, I might have already done it. You can find out at joshpeckdisclosure.com and just check. But I'm thinking the weekly show, I'm going to have to start a brand new channel under a brand new email address that's not connected to this or me at all, and try to just build it up brand new. You know, my other channel, Chalk Talk, I only have a few hundred, maybe 1,000 subscribers by now, and those videos are getting views in the thousands under the Skywatch TV thing, but it's a brand new channel, and we just talk about Christian stuff. I'm actually surprised that it's not censored more than it is, but that I'm getting more views. This channel, however, I'm now, like I said, since I basically painted a target on my back by trying to contact YouTube, now instead of getting 600, now I'm down to getting 80 views. So I don't know what to do. I'm open to suggestions from all of you. The main thing is I just want to talk to you guys. I want to tell you guys stuff. I want us to build a community here. And that's why the donations are so important. That's the only way that we're really able to do that. So like I said, I'm open to suggestions, but clearly YouTube is not going to be any help. They don't have any interest in helping us further any Christian or conservative cause. So we'll just have to see. Hey, and actually, I did mention some of this a little bit in my interview with Carl Tykrib. Now, I pre-recorded that interview, so in there I say, hey, I'm going to have to do a video someday about YouTube censorship and tell my audience what's going on. So you'll hear that in the interview, but it's because I recorded it earlier. But this is that video that we're talking about that. So, okay. Continuing on, this is kind of cool. North Korea is caving to Trump's I wouldn't even say threat, because threat implies that he's not going to do it. I would say promise to cancel the whole summit talk. So Trump has now welcomed a statement from North Korea that says talks to reinstate the summit are productive. So President Trump kept the diplomacy door open with North Korea on last Friday, welcoming this regime's latest productive statement and saying that the two sides are still talking following the administration's decision to cancel a planned summit with Kim Jong-un. So in a tweet Friday night, the president said talks about reinstating a June summit that was canceled earlier this week were progressing. See, when you get a bully, you gotta stand tough to them, and then they will cave because they're cowards. Kim Jong-un is a coward. So here's a direct quote. This is the actual tweet. We are having very productive talks with North Korea about reinstating the summit, which, if it does happen, will likely remain in Singapore on the same date, June 12th, and if necessary, will be extended beyond that date. Okay, so President Trump tweeted that out. Trump had canceled the summit following threats from North Korea, but hours after the U.S. pulled out of the meeting, North Korea issued a statement suggesting that the regime was open to talks. So Trump tweeted about that, too. He said, very good news to receive the warm and productive statement from North Korea. We will soon see where it will lead, hopefully to long and enduring prosperity and peace. Only time and talent will tell. So he tweeted that Friday morning. And he also told reporters that we're talking to them now, quote, it could even be the 12th, end quote. Here's another quote. They very much want to do it. We want to do it. We'll see what happens. Everybody plays games, end quote. Now, a top North Korea, a Korean official had issued a statement Thursday evening expressing the regime's willingness to sit down for a summit with the U.S. So here's a direct quote from North Korean Vice Foreign Minister Kim Kai-gwan. He said, quote, we express our willingness to sit down face-to-face with the U.S. and resolve issues anytime and in any format, end quote. Now, that comes from Yonhap News Outlet, which cited the Korean Central News Agency, or KCNA. So the official also said that Trump's move to call off the summit highlighted the tensions between the two countries, further emphasizing the need for a meeting. And the official also added that Kim Jong-un had been preparing for the summit. So here's another direct quote from the official. Despite all of this, the U.S.'s unilateral decision to scrap the talks causes us to reconsider whether all the efforts and the path we have taken is really the right one or not. Our commitment to doing our best for the sake of peace and stability for the world and the Korean Peninsula remains unchanged, and we are open-minded in giving time and opportunity to the U.S., end quote. But Friday, with the door left open for potential U.S.-North Korea talks, Trump suggested that it was the Democrats who were against negotiations with the rogue regime. So he tweeted out, "Democrats are so obviously rooting against us in our negotiations with North Korea, just like they are coming to the defense of MS-13 thugs, saying that they are individuals and must be nurtured, or asking to end your big tax cuts and raise your taxes instead, Dems have lost touch." yeah, no kidding. You know, that's what I really like about our president. He just calls it like it is. But following Trump's letter to Kim Jong-un, Trump actually sent a letter that was basically, it was sort of politely worded, but it was a little bullyish too, which again, sometimes you got to be like that when you're facing a bully. You got to stand up to a bully. And in there, he was kind of like, you know, we have very big nuclear capabilities. It would be a shame to actually use them. So following that letter, suggesting to hold the meeting would have been inappropriate, House Democrat leader Nancy Pelosi blasted the president, suggesting that Kim had won. She wants Kim Jong-un to win because she hates Trump that much, and she hates America that much. The Democrats do. Now, Pelosi described the letter from Trump to Kim as a Valentine. Quote, "He's the big winner, and when he got this letter from the president saying, okay, never mind, he must have had a giggle fit right now in North Korea." End quote. She said that on Capitol Hill last Thursday. Now, also on Friday, the president tweeted about the reported FBI informant who had communicated with members of his campaign in 2016. He said, "The Democrats are now alluding to the concept that having an informant placed in an opposing party's campaign is different than having a spy, as illegal as that may be. But what about an informant who is paid a fortune and who sets up way earlier than the Russian hoax?" End quote. Here's another tweet from President Trump. "Can anyone even imagine having spies placed in a competing campaign by the people and party in absolute power for the sole purpose of political advantage and gain? And to think that that party in question, even with the expenditure of far more money, lost," all in caps. Yeah, despite all of these illegal efforts and everything, despite spying on the opposition, they still lost. Hilarious. So after a high-level Justice Department briefing held on Thursday on the Russia case, Democratic lawmakers maintained that there was no evidence to support claims of a spy in the Trump campaign. Yeah, well, we'll see. It's because they redefined terms. You know, it's not a spy, it's an informant. The left is they're like diabolical geniuses at controlling and changing the language. So then you can never get at the truth about anything. It's this fog of just subjective, whatever you want things to mean is what they really mean. That's why the right and the left are just spar against each other so much, because we conservatives anyway, and I'm not even talking about like the politicians in Washington, because there's a lot of Republicans that I think are garbage anyway. But, here in the real world, us conservatives, we try to handle things through logic and reason. We give facts that can't be disputed. And we're really good at being able to separate our feelings from fact. We're good at being able to separate a subjective opinion from an objective fact. See, the left doesn't do that. It's all feelings-based, and they muddy the waters, and they say that their feelings are facts, and they say that, it's not a spy, it's an informant, when it's the same thing. That's the kind of word games that they play, and it doesn't work. It's not doing the country any good, and actually the country country's getting fed up and sick of it. They also do this with like political correctness and things like that. But the, you know, America's sick of it, and that's why we voted Trump in, and that's why he's going to win again in 2020, I hope. All right, moving on. So this is a cool story. Good guys with guns stopped a mass shooter. So police revealed on Friday that two armed citizens were both responsible for shooting and killing a mass shooter at a restaurant in Oklahoma on Thursday. Now, initial reports that surfaced late on Thursday indicated that the gunman was shot and killed by a single armed citizen, but police said on Friday that when the 28-year-old gunman walked into Louis's restaurant in Oklahoma City and opened fire, hitting three people, he was met by two armed citizens who pulled out their guns and shot and killed him. Awesome. Good. So good guys with guns have won. So here's a direct quote from Ron Benton. He said, "I spotted the shooter walking north up the sidewalk and pointed him out to the guy who had the weapon. And then there was another guy who had one. They were really screaming. They were like, 'Stop, stop, stop. Please put the gun down, put the gun down.' And I was pointing at him. I was like, 'Down, put it down, put it down.' And they wound up exchanging fire." Now, Oklahoma City Police Department Captain Bo Matthews said that he was thankful that the only person who died in the shooting was the perpetrator. "Thankfully," here's a direct quote from him, "thankfully, the only person that is deceased is the person who is trying to harm others, and it looks like others are going to survive at this point," Matthews has said. "That's the best thing that we can hope for at this point," end quote. So yeah, I mean, absolutely good news. This is why we need to arm citizens. You know, this is why this is so important. Because you can't wait for the police. They're not going to be able to get there in enough time most times. Most times, by the time you call the police, if you can even call them, it's just a lot easier to go like this, bang, than it is to pick up a phone, call the police, tell them what's happening, wait for them to get there, and then hope that you can survive and that everybody's not dead by the time that the police get there. And most times with a lot of these mass shootings, the gunman will kill himself after he's already killed everybody. So the police, it's not a viable solution. Now listen, I am totally pro-cop, and I love our law enforcement. You know, of course, just like in any group, you're going to have a few bad ones, but by and large, I love our law enforcement, and I really believe that we need to support them, and they're doing good work. But a lot of cops believe that citizens should be armed because they know of the limitations that police that's put on police enforcement. They're not able to get there in time, you know, in a lot of times. So you need good guys with guns. This is a perfect example, and this is also why it's not widespread news on places like CNN and stuff, because it doesn't push their narrative, so they don't want to consider it. But so this is good. This reminds me of a couple of things I've seen on Facebook lately, and it's absolutely ridiculous. Have you seen these ads for, you know, ways that women can protect themselves while they're all out jogging or while they're not the simple solution. It's not go buy a gun, or at least a knife or something, but it's not go buy a gun, which, you know, I've heard from people saying, well, it's really hard to jog when you're carrying a gun. But then I've heard from others say that you can do it just fine. You just need the right kind of holster or something. Now, I obviously don't jog, so I wouldn't know. But either way, if you're in that much danger of being raped, then don't go jog out in public. Get a treadmill or something. But listen. These ads, there is one that it's basically a pointy ring. It's like a ring that has like a little hidden, like it's about that big, a little hidden like sharp thing in it. And so if you're a woman and you're out jogging and somebody attacks you and tries to rape you, then you can stab them with this pointy ring. But as many have pointed out on Facebook, this is ineffective. It's only going to upset the guy even more. And you can just take off, like, the aggressor can just take the ring off. I especially if he has a gun, what's a pointy ring going to do when you're up against a guy with a gun? So the obvious solution is, well, the woman should have a gun so she can protect herself. You know, we like women. We want women to be safe. We all want that. We just have different ways of going about it. There was this other one about some kind of strip. It's like a techie kind of strip that that women put inside of a bra. So then that way, like when it's grabbed, like if a man is groping a woman or something, it sends something to an app on your phone, and then the app comes up and it reads on there, "Do you consent?" And then the woman can press yes or no. It's like they got together and thought, what is the least effective mechanism for keeping women safe? What's the least effective one? Also, can we ruin romance at the same time? Because if it is an actual romantic situation between like a husband and wife or something, you don't want to have to pull out a cell phone and put yes, I consent, and like that's just going to kill the mood. So it's ridiculous. But these commercials keep coming up about this stuff, but not a single one of them is like, just get a gun. It is the most effective way to protect yourself. And you know, I don't blame women for not. I blame these advertisers and people like Facebook that won't take gun advertisements. And they don't really care much about keeping women safe if they won't at least consider that maybe that's a better way to do it. Okay, so this is kind of interesting. A major donor has pulled funding from a university because they've discriminated against a Ben Shapiro event. If you guys aren't familiar with Ben Shapiro, you should check out his show. It's just the Ben Shapiro Show, but check it out on Daily Wire. It's actually really informative. It's really good. It's funny sometimes, and actually everything the Daily Wire puts out is really good. I had the honor of interviewing Andrew Klavan of the Andrew Klavan Show on Daily Wire, I watch everything on there, I really enjoy it. Matt Walsh is somebody I'd love to get on this show sometime. He's great. But anyway, so the University of Minnesota's lost a major donor over its handling of an on-campus lecture by conservative commentator Ben Shapiro. So for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he's definitely conservative. He's really smart. He really knows a lot about politics and the law and everything. But his speech, which was organized by Young America's Foundation, was supposed to take place on the university's main Minneapolis campus on February 26. But when event organizers attempt to reserve a lecture hall that had previously been used by liberal speakers like former Senator Al Franken and Senator Elizabeth Warren, their requests were denied. So they'll let in, they'll let in fake Pocahontas Elizabeth Warren, and they'll let in woman groper Al Franken. Yeah, that's totally fine. But Ben Shapiro, oh no. His views are too controversial. You know, he's too scary. University officials cited safety concerns over potential protests, and that's what a lot of these universities will do. They'll say that it's over the concern for safety, not of the speaker, but of the students of the leftist students who are causing all the violence and mayhem in the first place. So in September, Shapiro spoke at the University of California's Berkeley campus, which drew hundreds of protesters and led to several arrests. Ben Shapiro ended up speaking at a smaller venue in the St. Paul Student Center several miles away, where he was met by a standing room only crowd and a few dozen peaceful protesters outside. Hey, if they're peaceful, I'm up for a protest. That's great if it's peaceful. But some people said that it was an example of anti-conservative bias by the school. So in protest, an anonymous university donor pulled their annual contribution and will instead give the money to the on-campus chapter chapter of Young America's Foundation. So in a letter to University of Minnesota President Eric Kaler, the donor wrote this was clearly a case of discrimination. So here's what was written, direct quote, "I believe the treatment of Ben Shapiro was clearly a case of discrimination. It was not discrimination by race or gender. It was more damaging than that. You have discriminated against the free dissemination of ideas. The question then becomes why you discriminate against conservative thought. My simple theory is that the administration and faculty of our major bodies of higher education are fearful. They are fearful that once people like Ben Shapiro speak about their conservative ideas, the students will begin to understand a simple fact. It is the fact that they have been exposed to only one way of thinking and thus will be furious over having spent so much time and money only to find out they have been essentially brainwashed." Because of it's so true. Because of this, I have decided to give my annual contribution for scholarship at the U of M to Young Americans for Freedom. An excellent example of how much damage you have done. I am not signing my name for fear of political retaliation. Now, end quote. Now, YAF spokesperson Spencer Brown praised the donor's decision and said that it's important to take a stand against an institution that, quote, undermines and discriminates against conservatives, end quote. So here's a direct statement. "We applaud this patriotic American's decision to withhold support from an institution that undermines and discriminates against conservatives. Such a decision is an important first step in giving students a full ideological, diverse education that includes conservative ideas. It's a tragedy that this once proud alumnus of the University of Minnesota has been abandoned by his alma mater. For with the meaningful support of individuals such as the author of this letter, Young Americans Foundation is able to continue the vital work of holding schools accountable, including through YAF's First Amendment lawsuit against the University of California, Berkeley." Really interesting stuff, and I hope we see more of this. Conservatism is starting to kind of become acceptable again, you know, not that it never was, but in the leftist point of view, conservatism is just evil and it's got to be suppressed. You know, if it's such an evil idea, then hear the ideas out and come at them with better ideas. But they know that they can't win on that basis. They can't win with logic and reason because that's how we operate. We as conservatives, we operate through logic, reason. We bring facts into the discussion. We bring studies and surveys and, you know, we got all these things. But they, instead of coming at it with their own facts, they redefine what the facts mean. You know, they try to make the objective fact into something subjective. This happens all the time. So it's okay for them, in their mind, to discriminate, because they're not going to call it discrimination. They're going to call it protecting students or something like that, for safety reasons. You know, they'll use words like that, when really they don't like Ben Shapiro's views and they don't think that he should speak there. But the reality is that there are a lot of college students who do like his views and agree with it and want to hear him speak. So he should be allowed to speak. If they're going to have Al Franken and Elizabeth Warren, they should allow Ben Shapiro. There's no reason. I hope more donors pull funding. And I'll tell you what, I don't know who all watches this show, but if you're funding a university that does things like this, pull your funding and give it to somebody who will actually support free thought. And listen, that's the thing with people like YAF and, you know, like all these other organizations that are more conservative. They're not trying to shut liberals up. Actually, if you go, one of the best recent videos I've seen recently was Dave Rubin's talk. I think he was at a university or something, but he got protested. There were people trying to disrupt and there were people making noise and everything. And every time that happened, he said, "Hey, do you have a question? Let's open up a dialogue here. Let's talk." He wasn't trying to shut up the liberals. You know, he wasn't trying to shut up the leftists. He said that he'd be more than willing to have a discussion. And he did with a few of them. But most times, they weren't interested in that. They just wanted to make noise and they wanted to shut Dave Rubin up.
Fight for it honestly and using your mind and your faculties, and not because you silenced people or because you pulled fire alarms or called in bomb threats. If you fight for all right, I agree. Black lives do matter. All right, I'm with you.
Black lives matter.
Good.
Black lives matter.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, you listen, you got the script down. I'm impressed with the repetition. You know what? I'll give you a cookie if you can say something else. How about that? I got a whole tray of cookies back there. No? Yeah, do you think I don't think Black Lives Matter? What are you going? Oh, she's checking her phone to make sure she got the script right. Okay, come on now. I'm all about open exchange. This is what I do for a living. I will gladly take all your questions all night long. I like where this one's going. Yeah, is this a local thing? What's going on? Do you want to ask me something? Yeah, you can ask me something. See, this is what happens every time. Truly, ma'am, if you want to ask me something, I'd love to hear a question from you. So you don't have a question. Is there anything I said that you didn't like? Did you not like anything? You don't want to comment on that either. You see what's going on here? All right. Yeah, I'm with you. Solidarity against hate. I am with you. I'm with you guys. Let's try this. How many of you here are for hate? How many of you are for hate? Is anyone for hate? If we're at a hate rally here, as they would have us believe, anyone for hate? Nobody for it.
We are not the problem. We are not the problem.
You guys have a question?
No, it's okay.
We are not the problem. We are not the problem.
Are you guys the problem?
We are not the problem.
Can't tell.
We are not the problem.
You are the problem.
We are not the problem.
If you got, you almost got it. You almost got it. You almost got it, except for the word "not." Can we try that one?
So it was a really interesting. You should go find that on YouTube because it was really interesting, and I think that's a good way of handling things. Is, you know, we're not trying to shut liberals up. We're not trying to shut leftists up. They can spew out any ridiculous idea that they want. We just want to be able to talk too. That's all it is. Okay, now, has the dog man been killed? You know, I almost didn't even touch this story, but, you know, I do like kind of conspiratorial things sometimes. It's been popular. It's been going on around Facebook and social media, but there's this story that like a wolf-like creature was shot in Montana. And then you look at the picture and I don't know, it looks like a dog to me, or maybe a wolf, but this wolf-like creature, it was shot in Montana, and it's got people talking about the dog man. So, you know, if you're not familiar with it, it's this theory that there's this cryptozoological creature out there who's part dog, part man, and he terrorizes people. And it's kind of like Bigfoot, but instead of man and ape, it's man and dog. So it's this conspiracy. It's interesting. There are people that have written me and said that they saw one. You know, I don't know. I never have. I don't see any proof of anything, so it's hard for me to, you know, really get behind it. But I'm definitely all for people talking about it and having theories. And, you know, I think that's kind of cool. So they're talking about this dog man conspiracy and that the continued existence of a prehistoric species of wolf that this is what this is. But Bruce Aukley, who's an information manager for Montana's Fish, Wild, and Parks, said of the wolf-like animal shot near a ranch in Montana, quote, "We have no idea what this was until we get a DNA report back. It was near a rancher's place. It was shot, and our game wardens went to investigate. The whole animal was sent to our lab in Bozeman. That's the last I've heard of it," end quote. Oh, hey, Bozeman. That's where Steve Quayle and Tim Alberino are. So I wonder if they've heard of this and what they think. So the Great Falls Tribune reports that the creature, which is at this point, quote, "At this point, no one is 100% sure," end quote, how to identify, was shot and killed on May 16th on a ranch outside of Denton. The Tribune reports, quote, "With long grayish fur, a large head, and an extended snout, the animal shared many of the same characteristics as a wolf, but its ears were too large, its legs and body too short, its fur uncharacteristic of that common to a wolf," end quote. Now, social media in Lewistown exploded with theories over the creature last week, with some saying that it was a starved grizzly cub, others suggesting that it was a descendant of prehistoric dire wolves, and others going right over to the conspiracy stuff with the dogman theory. One person said, quote, that could very well what's being called dogman. They're spotted each day and the government quells any and all reports. Several people report being strong-armed into keeping quiet about their reports by men wearing black suits. These are just facts. Look into it if you don't believe it," end quote. conspiracy. So the conspiracy stuff aside, the Tribune quotes a wolf management specialist who said that there are indeed several aspects of the animal that are highly unusual and which he speculated might be a result of the creature being a wolf-dog hybrid, which he says his department has encountered a few times. So this is Ty Smucker. He said, quote, several things grabbed my attention when I first saw the pictures. The ears are too big, legs a little short, the feet look a little small, the coat looks weird, there's just something off about it. So they're gonna get DNA testing and see what it is. My suspicion is it's gonna be some combination of wolf and dog. You know, I mean, you can have hybrids like that occur in nature, and sometimes they look really weird. So certain animals can kind of hybridize with other animals if they're close enough in species. I think that's probably what this is. I don't think it's a dog man because I don't really see the man-like features at all in it. and so I don't think it's that. I don't know about the prehistoric wolf thing. You know, I mean, it maybe, but we'll have to just wait for the DNA results to see. All right. Well, hey, I promised you a Carl Tykrib interview, and I want to get to that right now. I talked to, if you're not familiar with him, he's an author of the forthcoming book, Game of Gods. He's like a UN insider or something. He's like a global government's insider, and he goes in, he gets all the information he can, and then he gives it to everybody else. He gives it to the world for free, which is awesome. And he talks about that. So I was honored to talk with Carl Tykrib. So here, check this out. Carl Tykrib is the author of the forthcoming book, Game of Gods, and he's had his finger on the pulse of transhumanism and global governance for a long time now. Carl, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. Good to be on your show. I really am looking forward to this.
Well, I'm glad to have you on Josh Peck Disclosure. It's great to have you here. And Carl, for the audience, Carl's actually sent me a chapter of his new book, phenomenally written. It's very intensive, so I didn't have time to read all of it. But from what I read, it is very, very good stuff, and I'm really excited about this. What made you want to tackle this subject? What started off Game of Gods?
Oh, that's a massive question. I've been doing research work in areas of global transformation since the early 1990s and full-time since 1997. And that includes helping a lot of other authors put together the research work for their books. And so on the aspect of global governance, that's something that I already was looking at it in going back to like 93, 94, and really digging into the depths of it. At one point, I was a member of a couple of different, you could call international foreign affairs organizations, ended up going to the United Nations Millennium Forum, been to other United Nations events. I've been to world government, and I'm not saying this tongue in cheek, I've been to world government meetings where world federalism and global governance has been front and center of our discussions. Everything from a global taxation system to the creation of world law, the list goes on. And so writing Game of Gods, I wanted a Game of Gods not just simply be to focus on one thing. It would have been easy for me to write an 800-page book just on world government. I mean, there's so much stuff I didn't put in that chapter I sent you, and you're right, it's really intense. That chapter is intense. The whole book is like that.
I love it.
Data rich. So when I was taking a look at what I needed to do to write this book, Game of Gods, I really wanted to, in a way, and this is going to sound kind of weird, almost have a Christian theory of everything.
Okay.
And so it's really a survey, a sweeping survey from theology, all the way through philosophy, going through the periods of modernity before that, pre-modernity or Christendom, and seeing all these transitions and changes in thinking and in philosophy and in culture and in how our society reacts to those changes right up to now. So when anybody, you know, whoever's going to read this book, anybody who's going to do this is going to go, wow, there's a lot of ground being covered. And there is. And global governance is one part of that. Same with transhumanism. That's another part that's being covered very extensively.
Yeah. And I've noticed in both areas, too, there seems to be a big push for this. But it seems even younger people, millennials especially, are really getting on board with the global governance thing, especially pushing for open borders and stuff like that coming from the political left. I don't know how much of that you have in Canada. For the audience, Carl lives in Canada, so he's got a whole mess of other political problems to deal with.
Do we ever?
At least we got Trump to make us laugh once in a while. You have Trudeau to make you cry. But
yeah. You just took the words out of my mouth. That's exactly it.
But yeah, I've noticed that this really big push. Is this push only a Western thing, or is it a worldwide thing? And where do you see this as an imminent threat, or something that we'll really have to deal with in a couple decades?
Well, it's something that's ongoing. It's always there. It's always just under the surface. And it's not just a Western phenomena. It really is an international – it's an international way of thinking. For the average person living, in middle America or actually anywhere else in the world, but for the average person, you're not thinking about these things. It doesn't really connect with you. But when you're rubbing shoulders in academic circles or foreign policy circles, or when you're spending a little bit of time within the diplomatic community, all of a sudden you realize that this idea of global governance, this idea of world federalism or some type of new international order has been percolating and remains percolating. It's always bubbling. There's always new ideas coming to the forefront. And it really doesn't matter what part of the world you're looking at, these concepts have been in play in some way, shape, or form. And this isn't to say that it's monolithic. There is definitely a certain amount of competition even between various groups. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was at the United Nations Millennium Forum, and I sat through a bunch of working groups. I was part of a group called Subgroup 6, which was reshaping world order. And we had one afternoon, and I bring this out in my book, we had one afternoon working session talking about creating a people's parliament, basically a global people's assembly or a world congress. And everybody in the room, for the most part, was in favor of this. But it was a three-hour, really heated, really intense discussion. And there was people who left. I mean, people left angry. People left just fuming because their organization didn't get the pull or the say they wanted it. And I realized after being in that situation for those 3 hours, Josh, that these guys are all in competition with each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all want the same thing. But there's a lot of big egos at stake, a lot of personal agendas, a lot of organizational concepts and agendas that are on the line. And so everybody is wanting it. But they all want to be kind of first at the finish line. And so, I realized at that point that, just because you are on board for world government or world federalism or global governance doesn't mean that you're always going to be getting along with your competition.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And we see that in really all political arenas are like that, too.
Yes.
So you brought up that there are some really dangerous ideas that are coming to the forefront and being more accepted. What are some more examples of that?
Well, some of these things have been tried and are continuing to be tried. The carbon tax. In my country right now, our nation is in such a mess trying to figure out this carbon tax. I'm going to charge a tax on literally everything. That's really what it boils down to, because everything uses energy, right?
Yeah.
The carbon tax concept, that's not a national idea. That's not Canada only. It's an idea that you see popping up all around the world, this idea of putting a carbon tax in place. Incidentally, that was something that we discussed. We discussed concepts of creating a global taxation regime. That's the language we use. It's a global regime, a global taxation regime via either a carbon tax or through an international currency transaction tax. That's been talked about. In fact, it's accepted in our Canadian law that when that happens, we will be a player with it. I mean, we already adopted this, I think, back in 97 or 98, the idea of implementing an international currency transaction tax. And it's not that it's happening, but already it's on our books, so that when it does happen, we're players in this, as good global citizens. And so just from that taxation side of it, yeah, those ideas are there and they're real. I mean, the reason that we're dealing with a carbon tax right now is because intellectuals who have an international mindset, believing in global governance, already a number of decades ago were saying we need something like this, an energy tax.
Wow. You brought up transhumanism too, which there's a lot of dangerous stuff with that. And you actually contributed a chapter to the Mel U, Welcome to the Transhuman Resistance. I was honored enough to contribute a chapter too, and we shared a panel together and did some Skywatch episodes, which was a lot of fun. For those who might not have heard of any of that, what was in your chapter that you contributed, and why is this transhuman movement, the idea that we can upgrade ourselves through technology, why is that so dangerous?
Well, you know, the reason I contributed it, actually, Josh, to be honest, it was an accident.
Oops, I'm a published author.
Hey, just like today, I sent you that chapter on world order, the cult of world order. A number of months ago, Tom had contacted me, or I contacted Tom. I don't know. I mean, I've been sharing chapters all over the place. I mean, after my book comes out, if somebody wants to piece together all the different parts that I've scattered around everybody, I'm sure they can pull their own book together. But I fired off this chapter to Tom, and I mean, this is the chapter from my book. And Tom read it, and he got back to me and says, I want it. I want it for Milieu.
That's awesome.
And I'm like, okay, I never even thought that. I didn't know even a book was in the works. And so I said to him, I said, well, you realize that this is the chapter out of my book, Game of Gods. And he goes, yeah, but can I still use it? Yeah. I mean, Josh, my stuff is always there to be used. I mean, yeah. That's kind of my approach. Whoever wants to use it, just use it. Get the word out.
That's awesome.
And so that's what happened. I mean, it was, like I said, kind of an accident. Now the dangerous side of transhumanism, well, first of all, what I bring to the table is, I think I bring to the table probably more than the other authors. I don't know because I haven't read all your stuff. I'm just kind of guessing. Mm-hmm. I probably bring more the history to the table, some of the more the philosophy, where the ideas came out of, especially the thinking around cosmism, and then the thinking of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, Aldous Huxley, a lot of the stuff that happened even in the late 1960s. What's interesting, Josh, is in the late 1960s, the scientific and the philosophical community were really wrestling with this idea that we will upgrade ourselves. We will direct our own evolution through industry, through science, through technology. Computing at that time, already the horizon was looking bright. The future was looking bright. And so there was a lot of discussion in the late 1960s that sounds almost identical to the same kind of discussions we're having now. Mm. And so it's interesting, as you start to peel this thing back in time, you realize that what we're talking about, which sounds so new and so cutting edge, it's not. Mm. It's not. We've been wrestling with these ideas for decades. Now it's just becoming more prevalent because we're all wired in. We're all connected. We're seeing this actually really, you know, coming forward in real time in front of us. And so that's all of a sudden what brings that urgency on. And not only that, we're able to take it much further than obviously what we could in the 1960s. But in the 1960s already, the writing was on the wall. There was already, you know, some experiments Jose Delgado implanted in the late 1960s, implanted radio transmitters into animals' brains, and then remote control, you know, control them remotely using like literally a remote control device. And lots of talk about what this could look like for social control, all kinds of bizarre stuff. You know, going, okay, this is the same kind of stuff that we're talking about now. How can we engage in social control through technology? And golly, social media has literally become some type of a system where we're all already kind of being part of an experiment and a certain measure of social control. You've seen this. I've seen it. I know a lot of your other viewers have, where all of a sudden, yeah, you know, where did my post go? And I better not say this, or I better not say that, or I better not like that. And you realize that, I'm being pushed in a certain direction, or at least I'm not fitting in with a particular worldview.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I'm glad you brought it up because I don't want your hopes to get too high that we'll get a ton of views on this interview, because lately, I got to tell you, YouTube has been suppressing the content on this channel like no other. And I was actually in contact with YouTube, which I'll have to do a video for my audience on that at some point. But I was in contact with them to try to find out what is going on, how to make it stop, you know. And basically, they were just giving me a bunch of copy and paste answers that weren't anything real. But while I was in contact with them, the number, I was getting 500 or 600 views a video, which I have 23,000 subscribers, so that's extremely low. But it went down from about 600 to 80. So now it's like nothing.
Wow.
Yeah,
what?
And because I just because I spoke up and I I guess I put a target on my own back. But yeah, so we're fighting through that. And we're looking at some other options for distribution and stuff. But yeah, it's the censorship and suppression of Christian and conservative viewpoints is getting just out of hand.
It is. And while this isn't transhumanism per se, it certainly is that element of technology controlling behavior, technology having a role in how your own life is going to be shaped. And it fits in the area of worldviews, what your worldviews are, and whether you conform to the viewpoint of the Borg.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. Well, we got a couple of viewer questions, and for those of you out there, if you manage to get through all of YouTube's brick walls and stuff, and you're actually watching this, go to facebook.com/Josh Peck Disclosure. That's a brand new page that I started for this channel. And whenever I do interviews, I will put up a post and give you guys the opportunity to send in some questions. So we did get three questions, starting with I think it's Stefan. We'll just use first names. Is global governance really the Silk Road Initiative created by China? It seems that all wars in the Middle East and all political maneuvering is connected to this New World Order trade route.
You know, the Silk Road is really interesting because it's a trade route. It's a networking system, and it is China putting its footprint all across Asia. There's big dollars. I mean, this is being considered almost like a new Marshall Plan, that same kind of size of an initiative. China has its own version of a world order. The West has its own version of a world order. Russia has its own version. This is where that concept of competition comes in. The European Union has its own kind of viewpoints, which dovetails with the U.S., with North America, but there is also some differences. And there's no real set answer to say it's going to look exactly like this. But China definitely is asserting its own world order across the Eurasian heartland. And one of the interesting things about the Silk Road is that they will be doing kind of social cultural outreaches along the way, putting hospitals together, putting almost kind of like an embassy all along the way. In other words, they are implanting their own footprint, their own diplomatic footprint, as the Silk Road concept is being developed. And so now all of a sudden China will have a far more profound and powerful voice wherever that economic footprint goes, because it's not just going to be about economics. It's going to be asserting the Chinese, the China-based policies and the China-based view that it really kind of is the sun for the Eastern world, and all the rest of the Eastern world are planets that rotates around China.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael asks, are the same folks in the transhumanist movement the ones in global governance also?
No, not necessarily. There's some overlap. I know that. When I was at the 2045 Congress in 2013, which was held in New York City, one of the things, and by the way, that was one of the largest transhumanist events, probably the biggest one in 2013. We had Peter Diamandis there from the XPRIZE. We had James Martin, who passed away only a few weeks after that event. And James Martin was the largest contributor to Oxford University in its 900-year history. James Martin is like in the 1980s was the fourth or third most influential person in the field of computer networking. some pretty big name people. Ray Kurzweil was there. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting with the 2045 initiative, one of the reasons it was held in New York was because they were reaching out. They were tangibly reaching out to the United Nations. They had a letter sent to the Secretary General, and they were asking the United Nations to bring this into the fold of global governance, global management. We need some type of international player to control and distribute the transhuman concept across borders. It can't just simply be one or two or 10 or 100 companies. We need to have a single umbrella through which everything can kind of fit under. And the United Nations, in their view, was that entity. And so at that, for me, it was really interesting because there was that bridging between global governance and transhumanism. The transhumanist community was reaching out and saying, we need global governance in the area of this technology. Mm. And I've been to a couple of virtual conferences in Second Life. I've done quite a bit of work in Second Life, including attending different colloquiums and different conferences. And that I've heard it there from the transhumanist community too, in some of those events I've been to in the virtual world, saying, yeah, we need some type of global governance. That's the only way this is going to move forward in a way that is equitable, in a way that, I mean, it's all going to sound really good, you know, in a way that we can share the technology widely, in a way that we can all evolve together, because we have to do this all as one. Otherwise, we have this division of classes and distinctions, and really, this is really about a form of oneness between mankind and machine.
Mm. Yeah, it makes sense, and that actually is a really good lead into Michael's second question. He asks, if the transhumanists run global governance, will they expect everyone to become transhumans, or will it only be for the leaders who can afford it?
Man, that's a question even asked within the transhumanist community. I've sat down with transhumanists and listened around the coffee table during some of the breaks and the discussions and even the Q&A time that we've had at some of the different events I've been to. And that's really a big, big question. Will everybody be able to do this? Or are we going to have now two classes of people? Mm-hmm. Are we going to have the post-human upgrade and then all the rest of us little minions? Are we going to have like a slave class and then an elite evolved hyperhuman class? How's this going to pan out? Most of the world just struggles to put food on their table and bread in their stomach, and let alone upgrade themselves. This is really something that, if we're honest about it, is the domain of the wealthy upper class of the world. This is not for the average person. I mean, it isn't going to work that way.
Right. Yeah, and that's something that I wrote about in the milieu too, because that was a question that I kind of grappled with. And what I kind of came to conclude is a lot of it will depend on if it's like government and socialized, if it's something that the government's doing, or if it's more like privatized companies. I could see a situation, it would take a while, but if it was privatized companies, say you got five or six of them all competing with one another, eventually I could see the price being lowered to where, normal people could afford it. Kind of like a LASIK eye surgery. When that first came out, it was really expensive, but now it's relatively affordable. I could see that happening, but still, again, it's going to be like, well, what's the quality of the upgrade and all that. I think culture is going to move that. Now, if the government gets involved and if the government tries to, socialize it or do like what they did with healthcare, well, at least it'll be a big disaster. So.
We're good at that. We're really good at that.
Yeah, so maybe we should hope that the government gets involved, which is an odd thing. But well, this has been an absolute blast. Hey, where can people follow you online? Where can they look up more about you if they want to get in touch or follow your work? Where can they go?
Well, right now my webpage is still down. It's been down forever and forever and forever. But the best thing to do is to look me up on Twitter. I'm under the handle Forcing Change, because that was our website, forcingchange.org. Lord willing, it comes back up here in the next, I'm hoping by the time the book comes out, I'm revamping it. And they can also find me through Facebook, and I'm on MeWe as well.
Great. I'm actually going to set up a MeWe too. I keep getting requests and people saying that I should, so I should probably try that out. What has your experience been with it, by the way? Has it been pretty good?
Yeah, it's a different kind of a cat. It's not Facebook. But there's a lot of similarities. It takes some getting used to, and it has a different place. And so it's not that I'm going to be giving up Facebook, right. You know, or Twitter. They each have their own strengths and weaknesses. And so I find MeWe has it fits in a different way.
Awesome. I'll have to check that out. All right, everybody. Yeah. Make sure you follow Carl Teichrib at Forcing Change on Twitter. And Carl, again, thank you so much for the conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
Josh, it's been a pleasure. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Take care and God bless.
Bye-bye.
All right, a big thanks goes out to Carl Teichrib for joining us on Josh Peck Disclosure. He's a great guy. He's a good friend. But, you know, even apart from that, he's just absolutely brilliant. You know, he's one of those people that when you're around him, you just can't help but to smile, and he kind of changes the atmosphere, you know, into just good vibes all around. So I love that. But, you know, all that aside, he's a brilliant investigator. He's an amazing writer. So make sure to check out his upcoming book, Game of Gods. Follow him on Twitter. We already talked about that. So at Forcing Change, and find him on Facebook and all that. All right. So as I said, donations are incredibly important, and you can go to patreon.com/Josh Peck and you can donate there a dollar a month. That's incredibly helpful. Patreon.com/Josh Peck. Please support me on there, or just give a one-time or monthly donation on the donation page at Josh Peck Disclosure. It really does help. It's the only way we're going to be able to fight against this YouTube stuff. And so we'll see what happens. I've heard good things about, you know, the Health Ranger is putting up a Reel.video. So I sent in an application, and I actually sent an interview request because I'd love to get him on this channel. And if you want him on, go ahead and contact him and tell him that you want him to come on this show and do an interview, because I think that would be great. No matter what happens with all the shadow banning and censorship, we're going to continue on. Like I've said before, even if I have to manually upload these to the website itself and you download them and spread them around, even if we have to do that, we'll do that. We're going to make sure that this works. We'll do everything we can. But a big part of that comes from donations. This channel, because I cannot rely on AdSense anymore. I can't rely on anything anymore except you guys. You guys are funding the show. I'm funding it too. I'm putting my own money into it, but it has greatly helped. We've been able to get some better equipment. We've been able to get some better audio. Lighting is next. So the show is improving. The content is improving. We're doing a weekly show now as well as daily videos, and it seems to be going a lot better in terms of quality and stuff like that. So all of that stuff is really good, and it really helps. Okay, well, that is all for this week. Thank you so much for watching, and until next time, I love you all. Take care and God bless. Right now, head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com, the central hub for everything Josh Peck Disclosure. Every day, you'll get brand new videos, podcasts, updates, and more. Make sure you subscribe at youtube.com/joshpeckdisclosure. Also, make sure you click the bell and select the option to always be notified when a new video is released. Follow Josh Peck Disclosure on Twitter at jpdisclosure and get involved with the show on our official Facebook page at facebook.com/joshpeckdisclosure. Disclosure. If you're on Steemit and prefer DTube, follow Josh Peck at steemit.com/@Josh Peck and make sure to upvote all Josh Peck Disclosure DTube videos. Keep checking back at joshpeckdisclosure.com for news, information, updates, and more. You can help fight against censorship by making a one-time donation or setting up a monthly donation to Josh Peck Disclosure at joshpeckdisclosure.com/donate. Or, for as little as $1 a month, you can become a Peck patron by heading over to patreon.com/joshpeck. As a Peck patron, you will be entered into contests to have your content featured on the Josh Peck Disclosure homepage, contribute chapters to a collaborative book with Josh Peck, and win a special Josh Peck collection full of materials worth hundreds of dollars. Also, for as little as $3 a month, you will have access to free downloads of Josh Peck books, such as Quantum Creation, Cherubim Chariots, and more. Josh Peck Disclosure is viewer-funded. Head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com for more information.